I started thinking about all of the mentors that I've had, all of my teachers, all of the people who shared their skills and their knowledge. But most importantly, they taught me how to create, how to connect my hands to my heart, to my mind, to be able to make an expression. And they gave me the confidence to do that.
That's Osage ribbon worker and multimedia artist, Anita Fields, sharing the thoughts she had when she learned she was named a 2021 National Heritage Fellow. And this is Artworks, the weekly podcast from the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Josephine Reed. Born in Oklahoma, Anita Fields, a citizen of the Osage Nation, is a renowned textile and clay artist. Her art reflects the worldview of Osage philosophy and its connection to nature as it explores the complexities of Native history and culture. Native American ribbon work is colorful, precise, and complex. It's the cutting, folding, and sewing of different colored ribbons into geometric patterns. It's a form of appliqué that's used as a decorative overlay, especially in ceremonial clothing. The style of Osage ribbon work is unique, and Anita Fields is an exemplar of the art form. An innovative artist, she honors the tradition while taking it to new places. For example, drawing on the designs of ribbon work and then incorporating that into her ceramic and clay pieces. And the results are nothing short of spectacular. And acclaimed. Her art has been exhibited both nationally and internationally. And her art is part of the permanent collections at the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian, the Museum of Art and Design in New York, and the Minneapolis Institute of Art. A Tulsa Artist Fellow since 2017, her work was also part of the landmark traveling exhibition, Hearts of Our People, Native Women Artists. While Anita Fields was named a National Heritage Fellow for her outstanding Osage ribbon work, she's clearly a multimedia artist equally at home with clay as with textiles. And that's where I began my conversation, by asking her about navigating these two very different mediums, textiles and clay, and the innovative ways her art frequently brings them together.
You know, my work as an artist is multidisciplinary, and I work in several forms, several mediums, primarily clay and textiles, and the combination of the two. My background is, you know, comes from very early childhood of learning how to sew when I was really young, asking my grandmother to teach me how to sew, but also just creative play, you know, playing outside with natural materials, dirt, mud, rock, sticks. Those are my earliest memories of creating. So as an artist, you know, I feel free to go in and out of materials. And so my practice, you know, covers a lot of materials, kind of whatever I feel is comfortable and what needs to be in the piece.
I know you were born in Oklahoma. Were you raised there?
We lived in Oklahoma for till I was about eight to 10 years old. I was born in Hominy, Oklahoma, on the Osage Reservation. My dad built us a home on his grandfather's allotment, original allotment. And we moved to Colorado. We made this kind of journey back and forth from Colorado, back and forth to Hominy, until we settled in Denver, Colorado. So my dad was there. He, you know, wanted to be a guide and outfitter, which he accomplished. And so there was this back and forth journey for a couple of years because my mother, you know, was lonesome, you know. So, but we always came home and stayed with our grandmothers during the summer. Yeah, it was a trek that we made many, many times during the year.
Your father was a painter, and as you said, your grandmother was a great seamstress. So I would have to imagine that art and an appreciation for visual languages was something that you really grew up with.
It was. My earliest memories really of patterned and design come from the trunks that my grandmother had that held her most prized possessions, which were our Osage traditional clothing. And she would open those up, you know, when it was time for our dances and for our ceremonials. And she would lovingly take each item out and kind of assign what relative would be wearing what cousin, what brother or sister. And as an adult, I realized that was really my introduction to something finely and beautifully made with love and integrity, which held all of the basic principles of art, which are pattern, design, color. And my dad was a painter, and he painted wildlife scenes, and he was really good. He didn't have a lot of formal training, but he really enjoyed it, and his passion showed in his paintings.
As you said, your grandmother taught you to sew. This is random, but do you remember the first thing you made?
Oh, I do. Yeah. So my grandmother was a great seamstress, and she had these baskets full of scraps of fabric, and she would just throw them in there, and I would kind of play around with those. And so one day I asked her, I said, teach me how to sew. So she taught me with a needle and thread, first of all, you know, how to sew, and encouraged me to do that for quite a while. And I had this crazy cheap rubber doll from the dime store, and she was probably only about 5 or 6 inches high. And so I made her a gingham. It was blue gingham. I can picture it right now. Blue gingham coat. I went into my grandmother's bathroom, and she had this little glass container of cotton balls. Pulled out some of those cotton balls and glued them onto the cuffs and to the collar of the coat. It's funny, I don't remember a whole lot of clothing that I made for that doll after that, but that memory is really vivid to me.
You ended up going to the Institute of American Indian Arts, and you went to study painting, but there you discovered other media. Tell me about the experience of being there.
Okay, at the Institute of American Indian Arts, we were encouraged to try every medium that was available to us. And, you know, at that time, I had very little experience with other mediums other than the ones that I was introduced to in high school or that, you know, I had found on my own. So we were highly encouraged just to try a little bit of everything, hoping, you know, that we would land in a place where our passion was really at. So that was my first introduction to clay and to multimedia. And I felt like clay was, that I was home, that I was very comfortable with it. It felt very intuitive to me, you know, to be working with it. It's just something that's very easy to form, manipulate. It's very human-like. You know, it has a memory. For instance, if you roll out a piece of clay and you crack it and you repair it, it's going to kind of remember that place where it was torn or where it was, you know, hadn't been repaired. Yeah, it has lots of characteristics. You know, it can be forgiving. It can be easily transformed. That's one of the things that I really, really am drawn to by working with clay is that it's a very transformative material to work with. And, of course, it's the earth that holds us up, provides everything for us.
You were at the Institute of American Indian Arts at a very interesting time. Things were really breaking up and breaking out when you were a student there, correct?
Yes. Yeah, there was lots of things happening, you know, in the world at that time. And this was a time during when there was, civil unrest. And also, you know, for Native people, that is during the time that Wounded Knee was happening, you know, and protests were popping up on Native reservations, on Indian land. So there was a lot happening, and, you know, that filtered through to the kind of work that people were doing at the Institute of American Indian Arts.
Yeah, I would think. And you met your husband in Santa Fe, and he's a photographer whose work is really pretty fabulous.
Right.
And you got married and began having children. Did you return to Oklahoma then? Did you stay in Santa Fe? Just geographically, where were you situated at that time?
Came back to Oklahoma.
Okay, here's the question. How did you juggle making art and being a young mother?
That's a great question because it was really difficult. I found myself, you know, wanting to continue to create. And so I would always try to find a community center, a junior college. Sometimes I just enrolled in classes, you know, to be able to have a studio to go to work at. Always taking classes, you know, to further, you know, my practice, you know, and finding new ways to be able to create. But it's hard, you know, because having little children, there's little time left for that kind of thing. So it was definitely a juggling act that went on for quite some time. But luckily, I always found the time to be able to satisfy that urge to be able to make something and to be able to create.
Is this when you began to learn ribbon work, or had your grandmother taught you some of the aspects of it previously?
My grandmother did not teach me some of the aspects of ribbon work. So when I was pregnant with my daughter, my husband worked for the Osage Nation from, you know, he's not Osage, but he worked for my nation. And so they held classes at the Osage Museum for ribbon work, shirt making, Indian dyes, you know, a lot of the cultural items that we use and make within our culture. So these classes were free and they would provide all the materials and, you know, had great mentors, great teachers who were very knowledgeable, who were skillful, who were masters at what they did. And they were very generous in sharing that with the people who had interest in learning how to make these things. So they would begin you with kind of the simpler designs and encourage you to, you know, keep working up into the more difficult stages of making these items.
Well, I saw a YouTube video of you making a ribbon, and it is an immensely complicated process. Do you think it's something that you can describe so even though we're listening to it, we can kind of see it in our mind's eye?
I'll try.
I know it's asking a lot.
Well, we use all kinds of ribbons. Depending on what pattern you're going to work on, if you're working on a four-ribbon pattern, the ribbons perhaps might be 2 to 3 inches wide, and you would sew those two down the middle to create a seam, open those up. You would baste on top two other ribbons that are of contrasting colors. You would take a design. For us, Osages are known for their patterns that are geometric. And you would trace your pattern on one side. You would flip that pattern to go on top of the ribbon on the other side. And then this is a process of cutting and folding under those top ribbons. When you fold those under, when you snip and fold those ribbons under, the two colors that are underneath, those top colors, create the design. And so then depending on what it's going to be for, if it's going to be for a woman's skirt or a man's blanket, it just depends on what it's going to be for, would be how long, you know, that pattern needs to travel.
I saw that in my head, so that was good.
I was like, I don't know if this will make sense or not, but, you know, it's definitely visual.
They're used for skirts or for blankets, decorative items that people would wear.
Sure. So they decorate the traditional clothing that we wear, and they trim women's skirts, and women have traditional Osage women blankets, so they also would be added to those. Osage men have a blanket that they wear, and then that can be also the border for those blankets. The suits that men wear for the traditional dances are trimmed. The men's breechcloths, their leggings, all of that is trimmed with ribbon work.
And the designs have meanings. I mean, there's significance to the patterns that are used. Is that correct?
Yes, they do. And some of them are easily identifiable, like the double arrow pattern. There's different patterns that have evolved. There are patterns that at one time denoted clans or, you know, belonged to families. And, you know, depending on how you were taught and who introduced you to ribbon work, some of those names are going to vary a little bit.
You've said that your artwork is really guided by Osage philosophy, and duality really has a centrality in the philosophy and in your work. Can you share a little bit more about that philosophy and then how you manifest it through your art?
So I'm looking into the worldview of Osage, of our culture, and that is a worldview that is based on observation of nature, that there is an order found within nature. And so our worldview, you know, thinks of divisions between the earth and sky, and so they found that to be true in everything that, you know, happened within one's life. So this idea of earth, sky, night, day, man, woman, you know, really these contrasts and these things that are, you know, that you find in everyday life, in one's time here, in one's journey. And so, for instance, things like the movement of the sun, that is something that happens every single day, and that it has a path and that it has order, and, you know, that there's order found in nature, on this observation of nature, where everything is interconnected and things rely on one another to exist.
You had said that you really came to a decision that art is what you're going to do. You really just committed yourself to art. Can you tell me about that moment and what shifted for you when you made that decision moving forward?
I was young. Well, actually, I wasn't that young. It was very distinct. It was very direct. And, you know, I was at a time in my life when I was having a lot of difficulty, you know, in deciding, you know, what was true for myself. What was it that I needed to be doing? And, you know, I was really looking something to ground myself and to really find out what it is I was supposed to be doing my rest of my life. And so I knew that making art was part of that. I knew I was having a difficult time attaining that, you know, because all of these other things that were happening in my life. And so I just really made a commitment to be able to honor my time here and begin doing what I was supposed to be doing. And that really was the shift, because I think it was the shift in my, you know, in my heart, in my mind, you know, alerting my hands that this is what I was going to be doing. And I fully committed right then and there.
Were you working in both textiles and clay then?
More so in clay at that time.
When I think about working with clay, and this is everything to do with me and being limited, I tend to think of things being functional, you know, making things that are beautiful, but functional. You make things that tell stories. That is a qualitative difference. Can you tell me how you arrived at that?
Well, that was actually with that shift, you know, that I'm talking about, because up to that point, I did make things that were utilitarian. That's pretty much what I was doing. I was making things that are utilitarian, you know, that you can use. And it was when I made that shift in my mind that, you know, I decided to tell things that were, I call them narrative. They're pieces that are narrative in nature. And so, you know, and I can be inspired by lots of things. I mean, I can be inspired by a good book. I love poetry. I can be inspired by poetry. Many times before I begin a body of work, I'll just sit down and read poetry. I can be inspired by something that I see at a social gathering with Osage people. I can be inspired by, you know, the kinds of things that I was talking about earlier that is found in our worldview. You know, for instance, I make these landscapes, and they're abstract in nature. But, you know, to me, being able to travel to our Osage original homelands, which I have been fortunate enough to be able to do, brought this feeling of, you know, that the earth holds a memory, and that it holds the memory of the cultures who were first there. And because of the way that clay is created, that erosion, time, layering, I think of all those kinds of things. And you know, clay holds this memory, so it's the perfect material to transform these kinds of ideas. So, yeah, it was a definite shift with what I was talking about earlier.
What I find so interesting is work that you've done that make everyday objects with clay, but it's in the service of telling a bigger story. And I'm thinking of your 2001 installation in English. It's Call to Eat. I'm not going to attempt the Osage pronunciation. And there you're presenting a table set for dinner for a family or for a party. Can you describe that installation and what you were doing and how it fits into your philosophy of work?
So that piece is called Wanambre, and that's, you know, the Osage word for come and eat, you know, the call to eat. And so this is particular about Osage dinners and the sharing of food. We don't do anything without the inclusion of food. As Osage people, we gather at that table in all of these instances, you know, from the celebration of a marriage, sending a soldier off to war, or welcoming him home. It would be naming babies, saying goodbye to somebody on their final journey home. Every aspect of our lives, from birth to death, you know, you gather people together to, you know, to come and share this food with you as an expression of who we are. You know, I find so many things within our culture so very beautiful. And I'm always looking for the essence of, you know, what's happening within these experiences and these times. And so in that particular piece, kind of based on memory when I was a young girl, you know, I was thinking about the dinners, going to them with my grandmother. So I used her dishes that she had, as many as I had left, and I press molded the clay into her dishes so that they were actually the dishes that my grandmother used. And then I used Osage designs on, you know, linen napkins and imagery, you know, that would reflect us. And I know I took my tape recorder to a dinner, and after the prayer, I told my relatives who I was sitting with what I was doing, that I was making this art installation, and that I just wanted to record, you know, the noise that was happening around us. And so I put out my tape recorder, and then everybody was quiet. You know, so, you know, I wasn't trying to intimidate. I was just trying to gather, you know, what it sounds like at a dinner. Because a lot of these dinners, they don't happen inside of a building. Some, you know, they happen outside under a tent. The installation included, you know, limbs and trees and a scrim to give us the idea of being in nature.
And you also had real fry bread.
I did have real fry bread. I forgot about that. Yeah, had real fry bread that I dipped in polyurethane about 10 times.
You take details sometimes from traditional garments. I mean, even from the patterns and ribbons, and you recreate them in clay.
Mm-hmm. So for a long time, you know, I was just trying to replicate ribbon work onto clay, like the surface, you know, when I would think about surface decoration. And it just wasn't working, you know, for me. It just wasn't happening. It didn't hold nuances that I wanted. And I thought, well, you know, ribbon work is ribbon work, and this clay is the clay, and the surface, they're two totally different things. And then I thought about, well, I could take my patterns and impress them in the clay and make clay stamps, and then I could use those stamps to develop textures on the surfaces of my clay. So I would take bits of clay and flatten them out, and then impress the clay stamps of ribbon work into them, and then apply that with slip to the surface of my clay forms. It's kind of like a clay collage for me. I liked that, you know, that worked for me, because it was just a layer, again, you know, of these languages that I have developed as an artist. And I think of that, you know, directly as that. It's a language that I have developed for myself. Because, you know, the ribbon work patterns aren't the only thing. I use all kinds of different objects to impress into clay to make stamps. And they can be from a walk. They can be from travel that I've had. They can be a favorite pair of earrings. They can be, you know, beadwork. So I think of it as a language, you know, that as an artist that I have developed that tells the story of my journey. But I also think of it, you know, as the language, that this is the language as an artist that I have chose, just as, you know, when I was a really young girl, remembering the language that I remember my grandmother and all her relatives and peers, you know, speaking Osage as their first language.
I'd like to talk about the exhibit Fluent Generations, which was a show with work by you and your husband, who's a photographer, and your son, who's a painter. And I can only imagine what that experience was like for your family.
It was, first of all, a great honor to be able to show with them. And, you know, we don't really, as a family, sit down and, well, we do talk about art quite a bit, but we don't really talk about how we influence each other, because that's just how we live our lives. We don't really have conversations about, you know, that relationship of my work to my husband's work or my work to Yadika's work. Yeah, I try to stay out of the creative aspects of when somebody's making something about, you know, what your opinion of it is, because we know that that's a real solitary decision, you know, that has to be made by the person who's doing it. We think of it more in like just real general terms, you know, that we raised our children, you know, to understand this language of art, you know, not to be intimidated by it, that this is very natural. And so that exhibit, we had to really kind of slow it down and really start thinking about those things, because people started asking us those questions. And, you know, I thought about it and thought, well, we just wanted to give our children a lot of experiences to be comfortable, you know, in the creative aspects of life, and to feel comfortable with it, you know. And if that is the path that they chose, then then that's great, you know, because we as a family all understand that. It's a language that we do understand and, you know, and deeply, deeply appreciate and know its importance, you know, in our lives and in other people's lives, how important it is in culture.
I wonder, when you see your work in a gallery or a museum, is it like seeing it with fresh eyes? Is it seeing it anew in some ways?
It is, and it's one thing to see it in a beautifully lit gallery, a beautifully lit space, you know, with lots of light and plenty of room around it, as to seeing it on the table that you're creating it on, you know, or taking it out of the kiln or putting it under a sewing machine. That's one thing, but yeah, when you are able to see it properly presented, it takes on a whole different air. I think more than anything, when I'm able to see a piece that I haven't made in a few years, you know, when I'm able to revisit that, that is sometimes when, you know, I have these really surprises and, you know, start thinking about, oh, I kind of remember that time, and I think I'm seeing, you know, this in it, where I wasn't really consciously thinking of that when I made that. You know, so that kind of realization oftentimes comes later.
There was a large, important, path-breaking exhibit that you were a part of called Hearts of Our People, Native Women Artists. And you created an installation for it called It's In Our DNA, It's Who We Are. And I would really like you to describe this for us, beginning with how you begin a project like that, how you begin to conceptualize it. Where do you start?
So I've been wanting to make a contemporary Osage wedding coat for quite some time. And I started that with my daughter a couple of years earlier. We started one, and then the opportunity came, a commission from, you know, the Minneapolis Institute of the Arts for the show Hearts of Our People, and, you know, proposed making the wedding coat, another wedding coat. So, you know, the wedding coat is based on a military style jacket that has history, you know, and that is an iconic piece of clothing for Osage people. They made their way into our culture in the very late 1700s at a time when, you know, we were negotiating with foreign powers, including the United States, you know, with treaties, and they were given as gifts, you know, by these foreign powers to our chiefs. And so they made their way back, and so that they were given to the women, and the women incorporated them into the wedding ceremony. But it's not just a wedding ceremony. These marriages were arranged marriages between two clans. And this lasted up until the 50s, actually, the late 50s. You know, there were still a few arranged marriages happening. And when that was no longer happening, the Osage, the wedding coat, found its way into our ceremonial dance called the Ilonska dance, which is a man's dance. And so they are used as a way of gift giving from one drum keeper's family to the next drum keeper's family and committee. And, you know, my initial thoughts were that this is such an iconic item for Osage people, that I think of it as holding this history, this really important history of who we are. And so I wanted to make a contemporary Osage wedding coat because I felt like it's the thread, you know, it's one of the items that links the past to now and on into the future. But I wanted my wedding coat to, you know, be something that was reflective of that kind of history. So on the inside, it has a silk lining that has been set up with Photoshop images. And these images are everything from historic documents, photos of relatives, the idea of our creation story. There's images from that. Also, there's oil wells on it because, you know, oil has impacted our culture in a huge way, the economics of our culture. And so all of these images, you know, speak to who we are as Osage people. And then it's embellished on the sleeves with ribbon work panels and different items that we, you know, that we use as Osage people, metal dots, embroidery. Most always the panels on the front of these wedding coats are embroidered, and so I wanted to hand embroider with symbols that are reflective again of our history and with plants that were and are important to us. I wanted it to be a reflection of all of those things and pay homage to the Osage people that I know who sew all year round so that our culture can continue.
It's stunning. It's just stunning.
Thank you.
I wonder now, Anita, as you reflect upon your career and what you've done so far, whether there's a through line and what that through line might be. Or another way is, are there stories that you find yourself returning to again and again that you tell through your work?
Well, I think, you know, this idea of transformation, I think is a real something that I think about a lot, whether I'm working in fabric, textiles, printing on cloth, you know, making a form out of clay, because it's this overriding idea. That idea of transformation is bigger than just transforming a material, you know, because when I look at clothing, I think of it, for instance, when you put your Osage clothing on, you are able to connect with who you are. And so this transformation happens, you know, not only physically, outwardly, but it's a transformation of your heart and your spirit and your mind, and a reflection of where you come from, because you're wearing the same type of clothing that your ancestors wore. So I think of transformation a lot in my work, in all of the disciplines that I work in.
And finally, Anita, what did it mean for you to be named a 2021 National Heritage Fellow?
You know, that I'm still soaking that all in, actually. Of course, you know, is really honored. But, you know, what it kind of took me to right away was thinking about the whole journey, the whole beginning of creating, making. And I started thinking about all of the mentors that I've had, all of my teachers, all of the people who shared their skills and their knowledge. But most importantly, they taught me how to connect my hands to my heart, to my mind, to be able to make an expression. And they gave me the confidence to do that. They gave me, you know, the understanding of there's no right way to make something. There's no wrong way to make something. There's only the way that you feel is the most expressive for you. And I am forever grateful for that.
And Anita, I think that is a really good place to leave it. Thank you so much for giving me your time, because I know you're very busy. And congratulations again on this well-deserved award for your wonderful, wonderful work.
Thank you. I really appreciate being able to talk to you.
That was Anita Fields, an Osage ribbon worker, multimedia artist, and a 2021 National Heritage Fellow, which is the nation's highest honor in the folk and traditional arts. You've been listening to Artworks, produced at the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Josephine Reed. Stay safe, and thanks for listening.